The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from National Geographic and the News and Observer. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in these articles that we'll be reading. They are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we're going to begin with part one of a five-part series based on the cover story from the July 2022 National Geographic. We Are Here is a story about how North America's indigenous nations are reclaiming their lands and the ways of life. The series, written by Charles C. Mann, photographs that accompany their article were taken by Kiliai Yuan. Now, before we begin Chapter 1, there's five chapters in this, I want to share a brief editorial by Interim Editor-in-Chief David Brindley. Now, this is titled Protecting Sacred Land, and it provides us some background for this series. The trees are precious to us, says Priscilla Hunter. We believe our ancestors' spirits are there. Hunter is a member of the Coyote Valley Band of Pomo Indians in Northern California. She's also a founder and chairwoman of the Intertribal Sinkeon Wilderness Council and the person holding the staff in the photo that accompanies this editorial. It's a group of women who are standing in one of the sequoia forests there. In 1997, the council acquired 3,844 acres of the Sinkeon Wilderness, about 200 miles north of San Francisco, along California's Lost Coast. It's lost, in parentheses, I should say in quotes, because Scenic Highway 1 avoids it, cutting inland to dodge the rugged coastal terrain. One could also say it's lost because less than 2% of the original old-growth redwoods there survived logging decades ago. Now the 10 tribes that form the consortium are working to protect and preserve their sacred land. I asked Hunter how they're accomplishing that. We're just letting it heal, she says. It takes a long time to heal an area that has been cut and cut and cut, she told me. People are saying, what are you guys doing with it? Letting it heal. How are you guys managing it? Letting it heal. Their efforts have gained attention. Last December, the Save the Redwoods League, an established nonprofit group in the area, gave the council 523 more acres of California coastal forest, designated as Tch-i-le-don, meaning fish run place in the Sinkeon language. The land includes nearly 200 acres of old growth redwoods. We were really pleased to have a place that still has some of the ancient trees, Hunter says. It's going to save some trees so the critters will have a place to be safe, the fish and birds and all that. The Sinkeon Council is just one example of how indigenous peoples and communities across the United States and Canada are taking control of their land, laws, and destiny. This month's cover, again, this is July 2022, We Are Here explores how Native nations are reclaiming their sovereignty and rebuilding their cultures. And then, of course, essays written by Interim Editor-in-Chief David Brindley. So, now Chapter 1, Reclaiming the Land, and this chapter focuses on the Tiliokiat of British Columbia. The block of red cedar was about 6 feet long and 3 feet high and almost as wide. Gordon Dick was slicing off its rounded top. The chainsaw bit into it, spraying sawdust. Noise-canceling headphones on, Joe Martin crouched to watch where the blade poked through. With his right hand, he made his little signals, up a bit, down, good. The air filled with the sharp, almost medicinal scent of cedar. Martin is a Tiliokiat artist on the west coast of Vancouver Island in British Columbia. Dick, another carver, is from the Shashiant, a neighboring nation. They were making the first rough cuts on a statue of a wolf sitting on its haunches, a short totem pole in effect. Nearby were two larger poles, almost complete, 24 feet and 30 feet tall. Up one side of each pole, stacked atop each other, were symbolic figures, bears, suns, mythical sea serpents, more wolves. This summer, Martin will erect one of the poles in the family's village of Opisant on the Mears Island near the Vancouver Island resort town of Tofino. Opisant had hundreds until 1884, when a Canadian law forced native people to let collectors in museums freely take them, which they did. Like stained glass windows in cathedrals, totem poles are visual representations of traditional teachings, but their imposing presence makes them more than that, Martin told me. They say, "We are here. This is our space." Mears Island is part of the Tiliokiat homeland. So are Tofino and scores of islands, Clayoquot Sound. Clayoquot is an older spelling of the nation's name. And then we have Canada says these 400 square miles are a mix of national park, provincial timber zones, and private land with a few tiny native village sites. But the Tiliokiat say it's all of their territory and always has been, and they have declared the entire area to be tribal parks. Much of this area has been logged badly by firms that stripped the country of its valuable ancient cedar and created erosion and ruin. They came and left, says Saya Maso, head of the Tiliokiat Natural Resources Department. That was 50 years ago, and they didn't restore the land, and neither did British Columbia or Canada, so we're doing it. The Tiliokiat are rechanneling streams, recreating the pre-logging ecosystem, protecting herring spawning areas, and blockading logging roads in delicate spots where visitors shouldn't go. On top of the conservation work, they are beginning the tedious but vital business of nation building, starting their own education programs, hiring their own rangers, known as parks guardians, and possibly, most important, persuading businesses to add something akin to a sales tax, a voluntary 1% surcharge to their customers' bills to support the nation's endeavors. When Native people talk about this work, they often use the word sovereignty. Typically, sovereignty means self-rule. But people like Maso and Martin mean more than that by the term. It stands for a vision of Native societies as autonomous cultures, part of the modern world but rooted in their long-standing values, working as equal partners with non-tribal governments at every level. The closest English term that I know to what we mean by sovereignty is self-actualization, said Leroy Littlebear of the Kainai Blood, an emeritus law professor at the University of Lethbridge. Littlebear played a key role in the enshrinement of Indigenous rights in the Canadian Constitution in 1982. The Tiliokiat are not alone or even exceptional. All over Turtle Island, common indigenous name for North America, from origin stories about the world being atop a turtle shell, its original inhabitants are reclaiming a status that they have never surrendered, and in the process are changing their own lives and those of their neighbors. And perhaps most remarkable, they have gained a measure of acceptance from the non-tribal world. The effects range from tribal police in Montana successfully defending their right to detain non-natives whom they suspect of committing crimes on their lands, to boards in Canada that take input from Indigenous and government representatives and jointly oversee environmental issues across nearly 1.7 million square miles, or about 40% of the country. Most of this work is small scale, almost under the radar, such as the collaboration among the Nakota, the Assiniboine, the Anjanai, the Groves Venche, and the U.S. Bureau of Land Management to restore prairie land in Montana. But some of it has thunderous impact, like the U.S. Supreme Court ruling in 2020 that led lower courts to affirm nearly half of Oklahoma is native land. Much as African-American activists pushed civil rights through litigation and legislation that built incrementally, Native nations have pushed to regain sovereignty methodically, one lawsuit, one negotiation, one law, one program at a time. For decades, the Tiliokiat protested that they had never signed a treaty with British Columbia and thus had given up none of their rights or land. Until 1993, the province refused even to negotiate. Only in October of last year, after 19 years of talks and several side agreements, did it agree to framework for discussions. The process has been grindingly slow, but the change is undeniable. As the roadside sign that greets visitors entering tribal territory, the Tiliokiat and the Haluetie the Teleokiat homeland. None of this is foreordained to continue. More than 42% of the officially recognized tribes in the United States have no federally or state-recognized reservation, and the reservations of tribes that possess them are a tiny fraction of what they had in the past. Native peoples are among their poorest and unhealthiest on the continent, with some of the highest rates of drug overdose deaths of any racial or ethnic group. Indigenous women, in particular, face violence at horrific rates. Most worrisome for activists, the U.S. and Canadian governments retain the power to dismantle Native victories at any time. When I asked Saya Maso what he hoped to see in 5 to 10 years, he gave me a list: improved health care, a museum and cultural center, a tribal longhouse to replace the one destroyed in the 19th century, a bigger, higher-paid parks guardian force, better sewage treatment, an entire Teleokiat school system. The key to all that is building the tribal economic base, he said, and the root of doing that is sovereignty, nation to nation. The world doesn't know we're equal, he said, but we're getting better at telling them. And that begins part two, which we will continue with in our next episode of Armchair Traveler. By the way, the Teleokiat, one of 14 nations of the New Chanuth on the Vancouver Island, established 4 adjacent tribal parks as an expression of their inherent rights to oversee the land, air, water, and spirit of their territory, as they have done for millennia. The nation manages the watershed, ecotourism, and policing by parks guardians. Indigenous land use methods are restoring terrain ravaged by timber operations, and they consider the parks sacred. In Chapter 2 next week, we're going to read about the Chanta of Oklahoma. Next, electric vehicles are slowly becoming more common across the country and around the world. Writer Natalie B. Compton of the Washington Post recently rented an electric vehicle, a.k.a. EV, and then shared her experiences in an article, Tips Learned from Renting an Electric Car for the First Time. Her story appeared in the June 5th, 2022 e-edition of the News and Observer. Let's see what Natalie learned. My experience with electric vehicles is the same as most Americans. I know they're out there, but I've never owned or even driven one. They are an anomaly on the road here, making up less than 1% of the country's 250 million cars, SUVs, vans, and pickup trucks as of 2021, according to Reuters. And last year, EVs only accounted for about 3% of all the cars, trucks sold in the United States. And yet, interest in renting them is increasing, especially as gas prices continue to skyrocket, and rental companies are responding accordingly. In October, Hertz announced it was purchasing 100,000 Teslas. There has been a steady increase of EVs on peer-to-peer rental platform Turo, too. Albert James Mankahas, chief data officer for Turo, says they went from hundreds in 2014 to more than 25,000 in 2021. With a road trip on my agenda last weekend, and that was Memorial Day weekend, I decided to rent an EV to Westchester, New York, about 600 miles round trip. Going into it, I didn't know what to expect on the cost or availability of rentals, how I would find places to charge, it's called range anxiety, or if I could figure out Tesla software. This is what I learned. First section, it's not always easy to find an EV. Back in March, I tried and failed to find an EV rental with the option to pick up in one city and drop off in another. I have even enlisted the help of a travel advisor and still struck out. None of the 4 companies she called had any available, and even if they did, they didn't allow one-way rentals. The problem? It's still not common yet, says Aaron Gessner, Detroit bureau chief at Cars.com. Even though EV manufacturers want to sell to rental companies, there is a shortage of cars because of high demand from buyers and supply chain issues. That should get better over time, Ed Pepper, U.S. Vice President for General Motors Fleet, says EV manufacturers have a good reason to get their cars to renters, and that's exposure. We're confident that once consumers get to experience an EV for commercial or personal use, they are more likely to consider one, Pepper said in an email. the booking process. I fared better over Memorial Day weekend with Hertz. It currently has the Tesla Model 3 sedan and Model Y midsize SUVs, and will soon have the Polestar 2 hatchbacks. Once Hertz had availability for my dates, I jumped on a reservation without much shopping around. I felt burned from when I tried to reserve one in March. You could also try searching on Turo or Enterprise, which offers options including the Tesla Model 3, Nissan Leaf, and Polestar 2. Now, Avis advertises Teslas and a Kia Niro EV. I chose the Model 3, which seats 5 adults and has a driving range of up to 260 miles, depending on how fast you're going. Higher speeds impact mileage. My 3-day rental with insurance came to about $523. It wasn't a big difference from a fuel-powered sedan, $420, with the same insurance, considering gas for the trip would have cost nearly $100. The only drawback was that I could get it only from Dulles International Airport in Virginia, which is about an hour from my D.C. apartment. Picking up the rental. I had gone over some of Hertz's Tesla FAQs, frequently asked questions, about what you need to know before driving a Tesla, about like how to turn the car on and off and how to use the charge port. But I was not well versed in the technology when I got the keys. I'm more of a baptism by fire kind of person. Manuals for emergencies. Sound familiar? There will be a learning curve when you first get in, Gessner told me. Eventually, people figure it out. The learning curve hit faster after I got the keys, or rather key card, to my blue Model 3. I couldn't open the door. I hovered the key card over parts of the car like I had seen online, but I had no success. I felt a lot like a chimp trying to get into a computer. As I started Googling how to unlock a Tesla, a Hertz employee appeared and showed me to tap the card on the passenger door frame below a camera I hadn't noticed. And then I was on my own. The touchscreen directed me to tap my key card on the console behind or in the cup holders and put the car into drive. If you want to feel more confident before jumping into your EV rental, Gessner recommends watching tutorials from rental car companies or manufacturers. And if you have questions, ask the rental car people, he says. Adjusting to the technology. Where you would find a radio or small screen on most cars, you will find a giant touchscreen tablet in a Tesla. It's the center of the car's universe, where you can look up charging stations, sync your smartphone, log into mobile apps such as Spotify, control the temperature, see your battery level, and check how far you can drive, along with other functions. Now, I will inject here before continuing with our article. I recently had an experience to look inside from the passenger side of a Tesla 3. A friend had bought one. And sure enough, there's that large tablet they're talking about, like a small television screen right there in the center of what used to be a dashboard, you know, with all, this thing was nothing but wood paneling and leather and a steering wheel. You had to do everything from that, what looked like a giant iPad. So it gives you an idea of what we're talking about here. Some of that was confusing to navigate as we continue the article, but the car has a helpful voice control function that operates like Siri or Alexa. You hold down a button on the steering wheel and make your request. When rain started pouring, I asked the car to turn on windshield wipers, and it obliged. It was comforting to have my phone ready to hook up to other challenges I ran into along the way, like how to lock the car or find the hazard lights. Charging options. There are different methods for charging EVs that range from very slow to very fast. You'll want to look up the specifics based on your EV. There are several ways to find a charging station. For example, AAA's Triptych has a search function for finding charging stations. Hotels.com has an amenity filter that allows users to find properties with on-site charging points. Anyone can search online for Tesla's 4,500-plus destination charging sites, such as restaurants, hotels, or resorts, where charging is usually free if you're a customer. Tesla has a network of more than 30,000 supercharger stations globally. The easiest way to find them is through the car's trip planner, which calculates your route with superchargers along the way. The tool shows stall availability at each station. You can't reserve a charging station in advance. The Tesla supercharger can bring your battery up to 200 miles in about 15 minutes. Most stations charge a fee, which can depend on your electricity usage and plug-in time. Some have on-peak and off-peak rates. If you charge your rental at a third-party station, you pay on the spot. With a Tesla station, Hertz charges the credit card associated with your rental. I paid about $30 in charging fees over four charges. If you want to know how much your trip will cost, you can calculate estimates at the EVA department site at evadept.com. That's evadept.com. Before I started my drive, I plugged my destination into the car's GPS, and it automatically pulled up stations along my route. Figuring the car knew best, I accepted its first suggestion to drive to a charging station in Baltimore. In hindsight, I regretted the early detour. I had just started my drive, and the car wasn't at risk of running out of battery. There would be plenty of other stations that were more convenient than this one in a city. Overall, I made two charge breaks each way from D.C. to New York, about 15 to 20 minutes per supercharge. Even though I knew I could stop easily along the route, range anxiety did nag me. The takeaway. The Tesla rental experience was largely straightforward. The car was intuitive enough to figure out with the help of the internet, and the charging infrastructure made it easy to find stations. My best move was to talk to other Tesla owners ahead of my trip. My brother-in-law warned me about the car's ability to accelerate intensely, quickly. A friend's parents just traveled across the country in their Tesla and had no problems with charging. This advice gave me confidence for my first drive. Wow. Well, next, writer Salon Yegensu of the New York Times offers a rather interesting travel story. Now, headlined Confused, Overwhelmed, You May Have Travel Whiplash. Her article appeared in the June 10th, 2022 issue of the Times. And Salon discovered going from one place to another right now can mean being jolted by conflicting sets of rules and regulations, depending on the state of the pandemic at your destination. It can be a dizzying experience. Before landing in London's Heathrow Airport last month, I thought I had a firm grasp on the new layers of the pandemic level, the testing requirements, screening procedures, locator forms, health and safety protocols, just to name a few. I had recently taken a work trip from Istanbul to New York, which involved two long-haul flights from two major airports, and after successfully navigating that process, I figured traveling through Europe would be straightforward. I opened my folder and diligently checked my paperwork, the negative COVID-19 test taken 72 hours before my departure, the five-page locator form detailing my quarantine arrangements and confirmation that I had booked and paid for a $212 COVID test that would allow me to be released from quarantine 5 days after my arrival. Still, as I reached the front of the line, I felt my anxiety growing. I'm a British citizen, and I was coming home, but with all the extra scrutiny, it felt like there was still a chance I could get turned back. The officer took my folder and started scanning through the forms. Then came the question that sent my heart racing. "Where's your booking reference for your day 2 and day 8 tests?" she asked. I didn't have one. I had opted for the test and release scheme that requires you to take a test on day 5 of quarantine and didn't realize that under Britain's traffic light system, those coming from amber countries like Turkey, which has since been bumped down to the red list, are also required to take tests on their 2nd and 8th day after arrival. Thankfully, the officer allowed me to step to the side and book the additional test on my phone. It took me another $200, but at least I was allowed through. As I waited for my luggage, I felt exhausted and flustered. I'm a travel reporter. I had spent the best part of an hour reading through Britain's entry requirements. How had I managed to get it wrong? In the absence of universal requirements and criteria for entry, international travel right now is chaotic and confusing. Governments and developers are scrambling to roll out digital health certificates to make things easier. The European Union's Digital Green Certificate, intended to ease travel across the bloc, is currently being used by 9 countries and will go into use in all 27 members by July 1st. The experience of traveling from A to point B is overwhelming and jarring, especially if, like me, you spent last year cocooning at home. Now, because of my work, I've taken 8 flights over the last 2 months, and each instance, the airports have been packed, planes full, and people have resorted back to old habits of pushing and shoving with little regard for COVID etiquette. Added to the usual disorientation of international travel is the new dimension of adjusting to your destination's point in the COVID timeline as the pandemic plays out at different rates. Total lockdown at your departure point might shift to a more easygoing freedom when you deplane. Then the whole thing happens in reverse. Traveling back and forth in COVID time causes a sense of whiplash as you jolt between sets of rules and regulations based on the state of the pandemic. When I visited New York in late March after spending months in strict lockdown in Turkey, it was like getting transported to the future. Friends and colleagues in their 30s were being vaccinated, restaurants, shops, and cultural sites were open, and people were socializing like it was 2019. It was exciting to be in a place with such upbeat energy and to see people in person, but it left me overstimulated and exhausted by the end. Turkey was experiencing a huge surge in new coronavirus infections when I returned, and I went straight into the most stringent lockdown of the pandemic, which meant locals were required to stay at home, except for grocery shopping and medical emergencies. I was jolted back in time. Tourists were exempt from restrictions, but the novelty of emptying or visiting empty museums and walking through deserted streets wears off quickly. After all, what is a place without its local population, its restaurants, its cafes, bars, and culture? When I arrived in London, I stepped into kind of a limbo because I had to spend the first 5 days in quarantine at home. I was fully vaccinated and had provided a negative test to enter the country and didn't feel like I would pose a risk to anyone by walking through the park or grabbing a coffee. But breaking quarantine rules comes with a hefty fine of up to £10,000. That's about $14,000. I received phone calls from a government task force several times a day checking up on my whereabouts and compliance with the rules. Once I was in on an online work meeting and I missed the call, which sent me into a frenzy trying to figure out whether that would get me into trouble. Even after I received the negative COVID test results that set me free, it took a while to adjust. By that point, London, like New York, was moving toward normalization, even though many people had yet to be fully vaccinated. So the lingering threat of the virus made social interactions awkward and challenging, especially as the weather was cold and rainy. As a travel reporter, people often ask for my advice after navigating pandemic travel. Someone in Britain recently asked me whether they should take a 4-day trip to Portugal. I said no. I told them if they wanted to make the trip worthwhile, they should budget in at least a week to give themselves time to prepare and recover from the journey and acclimate to their new surroundings. And then just a few days later, Britain took Portugal off its green list, and the idea of a quick trip became moot. More whiplash. I spent the last 2 weeks in Switzerland, where I happily embraced the serenity of staying put, where times when I was tempted to cycle across the border to France or take a train to Italy just because I could. But after spending hours filling out paperwork and booking COVID tests for an upcoming work trip that would take me to 4 different countries, I quickly lost my enthusiasm. On Friday afternoon, that would be June 3rd, I landed in Saint Martin, the half-Dutch, half-French island in the West Indies, and the embarkation point for the first cruise in North America since the pandemic shut down the industry in March of last year. I was excited until I walked into the arrivals hall and was met with 7 winding rows of passengers clutching bundles of documents as they waited to clear immigration and COVID screening procedures. I cleared the line in 2 hours and 20 minutes. I, at least, was working, not starting a vacation. The hotel check-in wasn't any better. It took 45 minutes to get to the front desk, and when I was asked about the delay, the clerk said, "Sorry, ma'am, I'm a little rusty, and because of the cruise, all the guests have arrived at the same time." A little reality check on traveling there, right? And hopefully that will be some good information. That brings us to the end of today's episode of Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be joining us again next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you that the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org, ncreadingservice.org. Questions and comments may be directed to 919-832-5138, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.